It was an amazing sight. A great stream of humanity, bearing all the flotsam and jetsam of daily life. Maurice Birkbeck, a visitor from England, watched and marvelled in 1816.
Old America seems to be breaking up and moving westward. We are seldom out of sight as we travel on this grand track towards the Ohio, of family groups behind and before us. A small wagon with two small horses. So light you might almost carry it, yet strong enough to bear a good load of bedding, utensils and provisions, and a swarm of young citizens. Sometimes a cow or two comprises their all, excepting a little store of hard-earned cash for the land office of the district, where they may obtain title for as many acres as they possess of half dollars. The family are seen before, behind, or within the vehicle, according to the road or the weather. Or perhaps the spirits of the party.
In fact, America's whole centre of gravity was moving west. In 1815, the US border was effectively the Appalachians, the mountain chain that runs diagonally northeast to southwest, some 500 miles inland from the Atlantic. Only one-seventh of the population was to be found west of those mountains. By 1850, however, half America's 23 million people and half its 30 states lay beyond the Appalachians, after one of the biggest and most concentrated migrations in history. To the west of Pennsylvania and Virginia lie the states of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, today the heart of America's Midwest. Many of its earliest settlers came from the south, particularly Virginia. They settled in the southern parts of Indiana and Illinois, where the thickly wooded river valleys offered abundant timber for houses, barns, and fencing. Taming the wilderness has been a theme of America's national mythology. Technology applied to nature in the name of progress. Perhaps the simplest yet most potent technological symbol was the axe, the instrument that cut down the forest to build the log cabins in which 19th century US presidents liked to claim that they'd been born. The poet Walt Whitman held up the axe as a symbol of all that differentiated the New World from the old. In Europe, he claimed, the axe was an instrument of autocracy and destruction.
I see the European headsman. He stands masked, clothed in red. I see the clear sunsets of the martyrs. I see from the scaffolds the descending ghosts. Ghosts of dead lords, uncrowned ladies, impeached ministers, rejected kings.
But in the New World, according to Whitman, the axe served a very different function.
I see the mighty and friendly emblem of the power of my own race, the newest, largest race. The axe leaps. The solid forest gives fluid utterances. They tumble forth, they rise and form. Hut, tent, landing, survey, flail, plow, pick, crowbar, spade, shingle, rail, prop, wainscot, lamb, lath, panel, gable.
In Whitman's expanding imagination,
the shapes arise. Shapes of factories, arsenals, foundries, markets. Shapes of the sleepers of bridges, vast frameworks, girders, arches. Shapes of democracy total, result of centuries. Shapes bracing the earth and braced with the whole earth.
For Whitman, the axe had become the symbol of material progress, the herald of a democracy that would girdle the globe. By the 1830s, the migrants into the Midwest came less from the South and more from New England, where the land had been exhausted by a couple of centuries of cultivation. These newcomers settled on the open prairies of Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa, which was more daunting terrain because of its tough soil. The tall prairie grass developed a matted, intertwined root system that traditional cast-iron ploughs found hard to break up. Another new technology, more complex than the axe, was needed here to transform nature. John Deere was a blacksmith from Vermont who joined the trek west because of the lack of work in New England. In 1837, soon after arriving in Illinois, he decided to experiment with a highly polished steel blade for a plough. This proved superior both in cutting the sod and in scouring itself of clay. Today, the John Deere Company is famous for producing tractors. but its founder made his name with the plough that helped turn the Midwest into the breadbasket of America. So settlers gradually tamed the wilderness. In the 1890s, Frederick Jackson Turner, a historian from Wisconsin, claimed that it was this perpetual confrontation with nature in the West that made the New World fundamentally different from the old. According to Turner,
"The peculiarity of American institutions is the fact that they have been compelled to adapt themselves to the changes of an expanding people, to the changes involved in crossing a continent, in winning a wilderness. American social development has been continually beginning over again on the frontier. This perennial rebirth, this fluidity of American life, this expansion westward with its new opportunities, its continuous touch with the simplicity of primitive society, furnish the forces dominating American character. The true point of view in the history of this nation is not the Atlantic coast. It is the Great West."
Turner celebrated the settler taming the land by the sweat of his brow. But in fact, the speculator was just as important. The federal government was anxious to raise money, so vast tracts of land were sold off to anyone with hard cash. Supposedly, the price after 1820 was $1.25 per acre. But at the peak of speculative booms, the real figure could be $10, $20 or even $60. There was also massive sales hype, which became something of a sick joke. Here's one spoof advertisement lauding the city of Skunksboro, superbly situated on a majestic river, though it only ran during the rainy season.
"A noble bluff of 18 inches commands the harbor and will give sufficient elevation for the principal public edifices. Commodious and picturesque positions will therefore be reserved for the Exchange and City Hall, a church, one gymnastic and one polytechnic foundation, one Olympic and two dramatic theaters, an equestrian circus, an observatory, two marine and two foundling hospitals, and in the most commercial part of the city will be a reservation for 17 banks, to each of which may be attached a lunatic hospital."
So the West was the preserve of speculators and con men as much as genuine settlers. To help small farmers, in the 1840s, the US Congress allowed a legal right of preemption. Squatters who'd worked the land could buy it at the official basic price. Land sales were often dramatic, life-changing events, like this one in Iowa in 1840.
The suburbs of the town present the scene of a military camp. The settlers have flocked from far and near. The hotels are thronged to overflowing. Barrooms, dining rooms, and wagons are metamorphosed into bedrooms. The sale being announced from the land office, the township bidder stands nearby with a registry book in hand and each settler's name attached to his respective quarter or half section. 1,000 settlers are standing by, eagerly listening when their quarter shall be called off. His home is secure. He is lord of the soil. With an independent step, he walks into the land office, opens the time-worn saddlebags, and counts out the $200 or $400, silver and gold, takes his certificate from the general government, and goes his way rejoicing.
Land could make you rich, but taming it was back-breaking work. Here's the saga of one settler family, a typical story, yet one of particular significance. Thomas, the father, was an honest plodder who struggled to make ends meet as a farmer in Kentucky. His son was born in 1809 in a one-room log cabin, measuring 16 feet by 18. But soon Thomas took the family north, across the Ohio River, into the state of Indiana. There he could have secure title to his land, guaranteed by the federal government, and also escape from a slave society. Thomas belonged to a strict Baptist sect that abhorred slavery. The land that Thomas acquired in Indiana was virgin forest. So that winter, his seven-year-old son spent days with an axe helping clear the trees so they could plant corn the following spring. The family survived on deer and bear meat. It was a dark, scary place, as the boy recorded in doggerel verse years later.
"When first my father settled here, 'twas then the frontier line. The panther's scream filled night with fear, and bears preyed on the swine.
Just as the family was getting established, the neighborhood was decimated by what people called the milk sickness. In fact, the cows had been grazing on the white snake root plant, which proved highly toxic. The boy's friends and relatives succumbed. Finally, his mother Nancy was taken sick. A week later, wood was being cut again, this time for her coffin. It was a traumatic experience for the 10-year-old boy. Revisiting the area in his late 30s, he could still feel the pain.
I range the field with pensive tread and pace the hollow rooms and feel, companion of the dead, I'm living in the tombs.
Thomas knew that he and his son and daughter couldn't survive physically or emotionally without a woman in the house. So he went back to his hometown in Kentucky, where he knew of a widow called Sarah with three small children of her own. He needed a wife and she needed a husband. It started off almost as a business contract. But back in Indiana, the relationship blossomed. Sarah managed to fuse the five disparate children into a new and happy family. She was especially fond of Thomas's son, and he returned her love. At last, these were happy years for the young lad, now shooting up, neighbours said, like green corn in a good summer, to a gangling 6'4" at only 17. Although having only about 12 months of formal schooling, actually odd weeks scattered over several winters, he was able to read and write. Here's the earliest document written by him that survived, a poem about himself.
Abraham Lincoln, his hand and pen. He will be good, but God knows when.
In his late teens, Abe, as he was known, began to distance himself from his father. He preferred to lounge around reading biography, history and poetry, whereas Dad expected him to work. In those days, a strong son was a man's pension, guarantor of security in old age, and Thomas Lincoln was now worn out by years of toil. Legally, Abe was obliged to do his father's bidding until age 21. In fact, he stayed an extra year, helping Thomas move one last time into more fertile land in Illinois and breaking up 15 acres of hard prairie sod. Then, in 1831, he struck out on his own, piloting flatboats down the Mississippi. The story of Abraham Lincoln's early life echoes the saga of hundreds of thousands on the American frontier. The family migrations in search of better land, the grind, the poverty, the numbing bereavements, and the ambition to better one's father. Yes, many trod a similar path, but the rest of Abe Lincoln's journey was uniquely his own.